There is something I need to correct from our preceding lesson. My wife calls my attention to the fact that a statement that I made may not have been quite as clear. Perhaps you caught it as well as she. And it shows how the leaving out of one little word can make such a vast difference in the meaning. I did not realize that I had left out the word, but I made the statement, according to her, this morning that Christ was not willing to die on the cross, or was not willing to lay down his life or give up his life for the church, but that he actually gave up his life. Well, I can see how that leaving out a word there could make a vast difference. A little word "only" or "just" could have made this vast difference in the understanding of that statement. So it should be something like this. Christ was not only willing, or not was just willing, to lay down his life for the church, but he laid down his life for the church. He gave himself up for it. He loved the church and gave himself up for it. We left off in our preceding lesson with the 19th chapter of Luke, where our Lord had entered into Jerusalem, the city of God. And how that he entered the temple also and cast out those who sold and were making merchandise of the house of God. He said, "My house should be called a house of prayer." Now, this was the state and the condition under which our Lord came into the world. This was the religious world into which the Lord came. He came into his own, but his own received him not. He was the promised Messiah, the anointed of God, sent to his people to be their king. But they said, "We will not that this man should reign over us." That is, we will not accept him as our king. And imagine, the Son of God himself came to be king, but they rejected him and rather chose and said, "We have no king but Caesar." They chose Caesar, a Gentile, to be king over them rather than the Messiah, the anointed of God. So his presence was not welcomed among them. He came to dwell among his people, but he was not welcome. And here Israel delivers up the Messiah, an open rejection of the anointed as their king. And now we will see a little later on, as we turn the Gospels and as we turn into the Acts and the Epistles, God's unfolding plan for the church. Christ had already spoken of the church. He said to Peter and the apostles, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." This was a sad state. This was a sad condition that the Lord himself should come into his people and be rejected. This was not only a sad day in the nation of Israel, but all the sad day that it brought to the heart of God. For as we saw in our preceding lesson, how that the Savior himself wept over the city. He came into the city, he saw the city, and he wept over it. And this was not the only time that he wept over Jerusalem. This was not the only time that his heart manifested its burden by the tears shed, for they would not open their arms to receive him. They did not welcome his presence. And, beloved, this is the longing of God. It has always been the longing of God. It seems that this is the very purpose for God putting man here on earth. God created the heavens and the earth. He created everything. Man was the last of his creation. He placed man here over the earth to have dominion over it, to be sure. But I think I can see behind that a longing, a desire of God to have someone in his likeness with whom he might fellowship. For he said, let us make man in our likeness. And in his own image made he man. And in this way, God could have fellowship with man. In a peculiar way. And man is the only one of all God's creation who could appreciate this fellowship. Now let us go back and make a brief survey through the Old Testament to see God's plan unfolding and to see this idea of God's desire to be among his people and to fellowship them and to be worshipped by them. We'll have to go all the way back to Genesis. In chapter 3, we find the record of man's sin. In the midst of this record, we see something that is very enlightening. After Adam and Eve had eaten of the forbidden fruit, they became aware of the fact that they were naked. They sought to cover themselves, and they sewed fig leaves together and made for themselves aprons. In verse 8, we read, they heard the voice of Jehovah God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. This passage seems to suggest the idea that this was just a common, everyday occurrence. It was a habitual thing. Because, and I went back to the original Hebrew word for walking here, and found that it suggests a casually or going, a casual going to and fro. That is a walking to and fro, as though that God was accustomed to walking in the garden. Though it does not say so in so many words, I believe here that it was God's custom to walk and to talk with Adam and Eve. There would have been nothing to have hindered this fellowship. There was no sin. It was pure and holy, unmarred by sin. What was to keep God from fellowship with Adam and Eve? What was to keep them from talking face to face with God? For they had been made in his likeness and in his image, and with the intelligence that made them capable of talking and communing with God and loving God with a complete love. It's interesting to note also in chapter 5 of Genesis, that the same root word is used here in connection with Enoch. In chapter 5 and verse 22, it says, Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And in verse 24, it says, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him, or he was translated. This suggests that there was an unusual and peculiar fellowship between Enoch and God. And over in chapter 6, in verse 9, we read that these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. Here we see a blessed fellowship, a togetherness, walking together. Those who were agreed, having one thing in common. And their delight was to be in the presence of God. And this indicates something. This indicates that there is a heart that's perfect toward God. John tells us in his first epistle regarding fear, he says, perfect love casts out fear. And in that same portion, he gets the idea across to us that the person whose heart is filled with fear is certainly not walking in fellowship with God. But those who are seeking God with all their heart and whose desire it is to walk with God are those whose heart does not condemn them. And this God longs for. And God seeks for. And there's another passage that tells us something about God's dwelling place, where God dwells. Let's turn to, I believe it's in Isaiah. Isaiah. Let's see. The passage skips in my mind at the time. I thought that perhaps it was in Isaiah 57, but somehow this passage just leaves me for the moment. Oh, yes, it is. It is Isaiah chapter 57. Let's go down to verse 15. For thus saith the high and the lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite. You know, this passage tells us something. It pictures God sitting high, exalted and lifted up. That's his dwelling place. But also, he says, with those who are of an humble and contrite spirit. These men, mentioned early in the writings of the scriptures, Enoch and Noah, men who walked with God, had their heart turned toward him whose hearts were right with God. But it seems that this was not generally so among the sons of men. For in this same sixth chapter, from which we read verse 9 a moment ago, is the record of the sinfulness of man in general, and Noah being the exception. The wickedness of man was so great in the earth that God repented that he made man and decided that there was but one thing, and that is to put a stop to this wickedness and bring judgment upon the world for its sinfulness. He could not have anything to do with such a sinful generation. But Noah believed God and obeyed God and built the ark for his and his family's salvation. Another wonderful picture of one who walked in fellowship with God, who, it is said, believed God and it was counted or reckoned unto him for righteousness, God's friend Abraham. Abraham believed God. He went out into a land, not knowing where he was going. He became a sojourner. because he believed God and waited for the promises of God. Finally, God granted him that long-promised son, Isaac. And then when Isaac was 12 years old, God makes what would seem to be a most unreasonable request. But Abraham believes God and is willing to obey. When we get to chapter 22 of Genesis, verse 1, we read, "It came to pass after these things that God did prove Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Here am I. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, even Isaac, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." Now, this is a very significant thing. There are many precious truths that are borne out in this portion, but we want to center our thoughts upon one which relates to the lesson before us tonight. We cannot help but notice the quick response and obedience of Abraham when he hears the voice of God. He says, "Here am I. Here am I." And God then requests that he should take Isaac unto the land of Moriah and into a particular spot, into a particular mountaintop, and there he is to offer him for a sacrifice. And Abraham responded without question, in spite of everything that should have pulled his heart away. He took his son, as we read further on, and took him up into the place that God showed him, and put him on the altar, and raised the knife, and was going to offer up his only son, the son of promise, the seed of promise, as an offering unto the Lord. And the Lord stayed his hand. The angel of Jehovah called unto him out of heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him, for I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me." Beloved, it is no wonder that God intervened there, though he could have, as we read in Hebrews, Abraham believed that God was able to bring Isaac back from the dead. That's how strong his faith was. God honored that faith. And it seems to me that that very spot should be a place and a memorial for such faith as was manifested by Abraham unto whom the promises were made. Don't forget that spot. It's an important one. If you were to take one of the maps of Jerusalem and to look at it closely, you will find that Mount Moriah is the spot where the temple was built. That was the place that God recognized as a place where a building may be erected for his presence among his people. There is so much that we see involved in God's promise and his covenant with Abraham, to thee and thy seed. And God would not fall back on his promise. It was a covenant sealed. And since God could swear by none greater, he swore by himself. And who could keep him from carrying out this plan? But in spite of the fellowship that God sought with Abraham, God is working with a long-range plan in view. not only Abraham, but his seed after him. And through his seed, that he might bless all the families of the earth. And that includes you and me. And God had us in his plan way back there. He had you in mind and he had me in mind. Before we ever came on the scene, God had already made provision for us. He had already sought us, as it were. He knew where we were. He knew the condition of our hearts. It wasn't that he had to wait till today to try to find out who we were. God knew us. And he's already making plans, not only for Israel, but we see in the promises there to Abraham that not only through him, but and just simply Israel, that through his seed, that is through Christ, all the families of the earth should be blessed, which would take in us Gentiles. Oh, what a picture of God's love reaching out to draw man unto himself. Yes, this place, Mount Moriah, is a hallowed place. It's no wonder that this is the place that the temple of Solomon should be built. A place where that man may look back and see the greatest test of faith when Abraham offered up his promised only begotten son, Isaac. But as time goes on, we see that Isaac, according to God, was blessed. The covenant renewed. And the sons of Isaac, Jacob particularly, and his sons, who became the heads of the tribes of Israel, and how that nation grew to be a mighty nation down in Egypt. And recently we studied how that God led them forth out of that land to bring them unto the land that he promised unto Abraham and to Isaac and Jacob, their fathers, for an everlasting possession. Before they ever get back to this land that God had promised, a great multitude. While they're on their journey, remember, at Sinai, God called Moses up and gave him his plans for the tabernacle. That is a portable building, a tent-like building, that could be moved from place to place because this was not their home. This was not their permanent dwelling place. This wilderness was just a place they had to pass through on their way to the land that God had promised unto them. But God wanted to have this particular building erected before they got to the land. And the reason is given here in verse 8 of Exodus chapter 25. As God gives them gives Moses the blueprint for the tabernacle and its furnishings, he adds, Exodus chapter 25, verse 8, and let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them. That I may dwell among them. God wanting to dwell among these people? Oh, yes. That he should seek to dwell among a murmuring and a complaining people who had not ceased to complain since they got to the brink of the Red Sea. They murmured and complained after they got across the sea. They murmured and complained until they got to the foot of the mountain. And they murmured and complained at the foot of the mountain. And later we read. But God said, I want you to make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Oh, the desire of God. But they made the sanctuary, as you recall, and they completed it according to the plan. And then in chapter 40, let us notice They did it just exactly as God said. In Exodus chapter 40, the last chapter of the book. Well, let's go down to verse 33. And he reared up the court round about the tabernacle and the altar and set up the screen of the gate of the court. So Moses finished the work. He finished the work. Notice what happened when the work was finished. Anything that's done according to the plans of God will be blessed of God. Verse 34 says, then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of Jehovah filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of meeting because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of Jehovah filled the tabernacle. The glory of God was so great in the place that Moses himself could not enter. The presence of God was known. Thus, a remarkable day in Israel. What a witness and testimony to them. God is in our midst. Not as the gods of Egypt, but the one true and living God in our midst. What an encouragement. What a blessing. Now, we're not going to have time to go into a lot of details regarding the events that followed. But the next building where God's presence was recognized was the temple. After Israel had gotten into the land and settled in the land, as you recall, there is a long history of conflict with the nations round about. And the Philistines, it seems, were forever a thorn in the side of Israel. They were constantly bringing trouble unto Israel. But after a time of conflict, after a time of battle, a great victory is won. But in the midst of the conflict, we find some unusual things happening. You'll remember that Israel also displeased God many times, and Israel did not continue to walk even when they were in the land according to the will of God. They became lax about the things of God, indifferent toward the services, offerings, their religious activities. It was a sad day. Finally, David, you recall, is king. Things really went down in those years when Saul was king. Even after the great many battles he won, after much glory that surrounded his reign, yet things got into a pretty bad situation. And you remember that on one occasion, things got so bad that the Ark of God was actually stolen. It was actually taken by the Philistines. The Ark of God. The Ark of the Covenant, you remember, that was to be placed in the Holy of Holies. It was behind the veil of the tabernacle, of the tent. The place where the presence of God was known, there at the mercy seat. But you remember that when this was taken into the land of the Philistines, many people say it brought them bad luck. Well, that's no way to describe it. How could the Ark of God rest in the hands of the enemies of God? But anyway, David, that man after God's own heart, continued in battle until that Ark was returned to Jerusalem. Now, if you want to read a beautiful psalm, you can read First Chronicles to chapter 16. We're not going to take time to read it now. But let us go down to chapter 16, beginning with verse 37, and we want to read a few passages here. So he left there before the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, Asaph and his brethren to minister before the ark continually, as every day's work required. And Obed-Edom with their brethren, and 80, Obed-Edom also the son of Jeduthun, and Hosha to be doorkeepers. And Zadok the priest, and his brethren the priest, before the tabernacle of Jehovah in the high place that was at Gibeon, to offer burnt offerings unto Jehovah upon the altar of burnt offerings continually, morning and evening, even according to all that was written in the law of Jehovah, which he commanded unto Israel. And with them Heman and Jeduthun, and the rest that were chosen, who were mentioned by name, to give thanks to Jehovah, because his loving kindness endureth forever. And with them Heman and Jeduthun, with trumpets and cymbals, for those that should sound aloud, and with instruments for the songs of God, and the sons of Jeduthun to be at the gate. And all the people departed, every man to his house, and David returned to bless his house. Now that was a glorious day in Israel, a day when the ark was returned, a day when the people were able to return to their houses, and the day that David was to return unto his house. Now let us see David's desire. Let us see why it was that God granted unto him the blessed promises, that there should be one of his seed who should sit upon his throne and reign as king. In verse 1 of chapter 17, it came to pass, when David dwelt in his house, that David said to Nathan the prophet, Lo, I dwell in the house of cedar, but the ark of the covenant of Jehovah dwelleth under curtains. And Nathan said unto David, Do all that is in thy heart, for God is with thee. And it came to pass the same night that the word of God came unto Nathan, saying, Go and tell David my servant, Thus saith Jehovah, Thou shalt not build me a house to dwell in. Now let's turn over to the 28th chapter. David speaks to the people concerning the temple. In verse 1 of 1 Chronicles 28, David assembled all the princes of Israel, the princes of the tribes, and the captains of the companies that served the king by course, and the captains of thousands, and the captains of hundreds, and the rulers over all the substance and possessions of the king and of his sons, with the officers and the mighty men, even all the mighty men of valor, unto Jerusalem. Then David the king stood up upon his feet and said, Hear me, my brethren and my people. As for me, it was in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of Jehovah, and for the footstool of our God. And I had made ready for the building. But God said unto me, Thou shalt not build a house for my name, because thou art a man of war, and hast shed blood. Howbeit, Jehovah the God of Israel chose me out of all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever, for he hath chosen Judah to be prince, and in the house of Judah, the house of my father, and among the sons of my father, he took pleasure in me to make me king over Israel. And then in verse 6, And he said unto me, Solomon, thy son, he shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his kingdom forever. And if he be constant to do my commandments and mine ordinances as at this day. Now therefore, in the sight of all the assembly, or all Israel, the assembly of Jehovah, and in the audience of our God, observe and seek out all the commandments of Jehovah your God, that ye may possess this good land and leave it for an inheritance to your children after you forever. And thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For Jehovah searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever. Take heed now, for Jehovah hath chosen thee to build a house for the sanctuary. Be thou strong and do it. And then David gave to Solomon, his son, the pattern of the porch of the temple. And then we skip down to verse 19. All this, saith David, have I been made to understand in writing from the hand of Jehovah, even all the works of this pattern. What a blessed picture here. David, the man after God's own heart. It was in his heart that there should be a permanent resting place for the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah. It had been dwelling in tents. And this burden, David went back to his house and he looked back on the incident regarding the Ark. He told Nathan, he said, look, here I'm dwelling in a house of cedar. Glorious house. Permanent. In the house of, and the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah is dwelling in a tent under curtains. It's right that I build him a house. God said, could you build a house for me to dwell in? Getting right down to the facts of it, no house could contain the Lord Jehovah. But it pleased God that David had this in his heart, because God's longing was to be amidst his people. Oh, that he might bless them, that he might bless his anointed, and that there might be a continual reminder of all who would look to Jerusalem. That's the city of our God. That's the city of our King. That's the place of his presence. And on that very hallowed spot, that ground where Isaac had been offered up, so to speak, God chose that there should be a house erected there. And David gave the plans to Solomon, and Solomon proceeded to do according to all that God had spoken. Now again, there is a good deal of reading here which would be of great profit. And we're not going to read all of them, but I do want to turn to chapter 6 of 2 Chronicles. After the house is completed, the ark is brought in, and Solomon addresses the people. Well, let's go down to chapter 6 and verse 1. Then spake Solomon, Jehovah hath said that he would dwell in thick darkness, but I have built thee a house of habitation and a place for thee to dwell in forever. And the king turned his face and blessed all the assembly of Israel, and all the assembly of Israel stood. And he blessed Jehovah, the God of Israel, who spake with his father, who spake with his mouth unto David my father, and hath with his hands fulfilled it. And then, this is a precious chapter, and I hope you'll read it. The prayer of dedication. And then when we get down to verse 1 of chapter 7. The last verse in chapter 6. O Jehovah God, turn not away thy face, the face of thine anointed, Remember thy loving kindnesses to David, thy servant. Now when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offerings and the sacrifices, and the glory of Jehovah filled the house. And the priests could not enter into the house of Jehovah because the glory of Jehovah filled Jehovah's house. And all the children of Israel looked on when the fire came down and the glory of Jehovah was upon the house. And they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement and worshipped and gave thanks unto Jehovah, saying, For he is good, and his loving kindness endureth forever. Oh, what a scene of beauty and a scene of glory. That this which was in David's heart should be completed. After David finding it in his heart to build a house, then God says, I'll give you the plan. And God gave him the details. And David had it written out plain and clear. And he said, See, Solomon, that you make everything according to this pattern, just as God had said unto Moses. And then when it was completed, God's presence was known and manifested as the cloud came down. Fire consumed the burnt offering, and the glory of Jehovah filled the house. How could Israel ever forget? How could that temple ever cease from functioning according to God's plan? It's hard to believe that it could ever be otherwise. How that when at that time the pleasure of God was manifested by His very presence of His glory, was that not sufficient testimony from generation to generation that they should never depart from God, but should walk pleasingly before Him all the days of their lives, from generation to generation? But it did not take Israel long to forget God. The sad day came when, after they had gone so far into sin, that God's glory should depart, as it did. And that city that they once treasured so much, and that building in which to them was indeed a glorious building, that one day that city should crumble and that the building should be destroyed and those holy vessels should be carried away by the hands of ungodly men into a nation of Gentiles. But that's what happened. That's what happened. It was a sad day in Israel. There was great anguish and mourning, but all too late. Why had they not seen the coming doom? For God had said in His promises that if they should follow and continue in His commandments, He would bless them. Now that house that was once filled with glory was now filled with dishonor and reproach. It became rubble. It became a total destruction. It became the laughingstock of all the enemies round about. Indeed, a sad day in Israel. Now the people are carried away captive. They're carried away into a foreign land. They're scattered. And from this time on, the nation of Israel experiences such changes as they have never totally recovered. They were scattered to the four winds and are to this day. In spite of the fact that they have been restored to their land, in spite of the fact that they still maintain that land that was once given to them, yet think of the thousands and thousands who are in Russia, United States, South America, various parts of the world where they have been scattered. Now, this situation gives rise to something else which we want to take up in our next lesson. Now that the temple is destroyed, and now that it is too far, speaking of the time here, biblical time, that is after the destruction at the hands of the Babylonian empire, now that they had been thus scattered, from that time on down to the time in which the Lord Jesus appeared, they could not return to Jerusalem, though the temple had already been reconstructed, though different. It was not totally like that which Solomon built. This gave rise to another meeting place. It's called the synagogue. The word synagogue is the translation from the Greek word synagoge, which means congregation. Those Jews that were scattered continued to meet, many of them, and we will see the nature of their gathering. This is significant because it shows a great deal, or sheds a great deal of light upon the character and the nature of the early church gathering. And this we will take up in our next lesson, Lord willing. The synagogue and its effect upon the early church.